Ohio is growing its footprint in the electric vehicle manufacturing space. Big car makers such as General Motors, Honda, and Ford have all announced sites around Ohio to make components for electric vehicles or EVs. A new site in Dover is also preparing to break ground later this year. Meanwhile, the state continues to invest in EV infrastructure, such as increasing charging stations statewide. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. These investments come as the prices for electric vehicles are falling. We'll discuss the state of the EV landscape in Ohio. Later, dollar stores are the fastest growing sector for food retailers and outnumber big box stores nationwide. Now some cities, including Canton, are pushing back on small box discount stores by enacting moratoriums. Those conversations are coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us, and a happy Wednesday to all of you. Car giants General Motors, Ford, and Honda have announced electric vehicle manufacturing projects across Ohio over the last several years. GM in Toledo, Ford in Avon Lake, Honda near Columbus. In February, German manufacturer Schaeffler announced a new EV facility in Dover. In addition to those jobs, there are moves here in Ohio in regards to the EV sector. Last year, the state opened its first federally funded EV charging station, the first of 27 planned for across the state. Around that time, news also came that the EV charging station manufacturer StarCharge would be opening a new plant near Columbus. These announcements and investments come as prices for EVs are falling, with the average price in February of this year being 13% less than February of 2023. Today on our program, we discuss the electric vehicle landscape, particularly in Ohio, with vehicle production, new jobs, facilities, and more infrastructure. Will EVs really start to command more of the auto market? Later in the hour, we'll discuss some Ohio cities that are working to curb the amount of dollar stores that open in their regions. But first, let's talk EVs. And with me to do that is Jack Ewing. He writes about the auto industry, particularly electric vehicles, for the New York Times. Jack, good morning.
Good morning, Jenny. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We also have Jacob Schwemlein. He's calling in today. He is the director of the Drive Electric Program at Clean Fuels Ohio. Jacob, good morning to you.
Good morning to you as well. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Tom Bullock joins me in studio. He is the executive director of the Citizens Utility Board of Ohio. Tom, great to have you back on the show. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
And finally, we have Chris Shammy. He is the vice president of Hybrid Jives, eAxles, and a project manager officer for Schaeffler. Thanks so much, Chris, for calling in.
Hi, Jenny. Thanks for the invitation this morning.
Of course. And if any members of our audience would like to ask a question or join in on the conversation about EVs, manufacturing, and the landscape here in Ohio, please call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Chris, I would love to hear more about Schaeffler's plans for the facility down in Dover in Tuscarawas County. Tell us why the investment in the region and what exactly is going to be made.
Well, thanks, Jenny. First, I'll mention a little bit about Schaeffler. Not many people maybe know about Schaeffler, even though we have parts in about a quarter of the vehicles in the world, parts that enable motion. Largely, that's in automotive, but we also work in industrial areas. And in the automotive side, we see a lot of growth potential for our company in the coming years, and we need to be ready for that growth. So we decided to add another plant here in Ohio. We have a presence here in Worcester. That's where I'm sitting this morning. We've been here since 1977. And in Worcester, we put everything under one roof. We call it vertical integration. We put engineering, training, manufacturing, everything right on site so that we can bring our products to our customers quicker. One of the big sources of pride for that is our manufacturing apprenticeship program. It's one of the largest manufacturing apprenticeship programs in the state of Ohio. And we want to duplicate that in our new facility. wherever that may be. But we wanted to be close enough to Worcester that we could kind of cross-pollinate our best practices. So for that reason, and additionally great collaboration with the leaders of the city of Dover, we decided to put our new plant there. In Dover, we're going to really support whatever technology our customers are asking for, but right now we've got booked business for the EV space, for battery electric vehicles. So we're going to make electric axles to enable those vehicles to move.
So would it be correct to assume that Schaeffler first arrived, you said, in 77, to the region to support traditional combustion engine vehicles, but now is finding its place in the market and being supportive of the EV space as well?
You know, you tossed a softball up for me. I love to talk about this story. We actually started making clutches for manual transmissions. And, of course, in the 1970s, 1980s, that was great. You know, that was a great business for us, and we did really well there. But by the time we got to the 1990s, the demand for manual transmissions really fell off, even though I think every car should be a manual. We had to reinvent ourselves or close our doors. So at that point in time, we moved from clutches to torque converters for automatic transmissions, and it was a totally different technology for us. So that was our first, let's say, reinvention of the company, and now you're exactly right. We're in the middle of our second reinvention, going from parts for automatic transmissions to parts for EV vehicles. That puts us kind of in an interesting and good position. You know, we can support ICE vehicles, internal combustion engine vehicles, if that's what the market wants, or we can support hybrids or battery electric vehicles.
Jack, with the New York Times, when you look at the national picture of EV production and development, how do you see Ohio playing in that broader landscape?
Well, Ohio is very important to the auto industry, has been for a long time. I think it's the third state with the third most automobile employment. It's certainly up there. And as you mentioned at the beginning, there's a lot of very important car factories in Ohio. You have Jeep in Toledo. You have Honda in Marysville. You have a lot of suppliers, Schaeffler, but others like Dana Corp in Toledo. And you have a big Ultium battery plant in near Warren. That's a joint venture of GM and LG Energy, a Korean battery company. So there's definitely Ohio is key to the whole electric vehicle transition.
And is that by accident that these companies maybe historically were building in Ohio and now we're seeing kind of the support for a new EV landscape? Or do you think that once the infrastructure of production was here, it's easy to kind of stay in the region?
Well, it's a little of both. I mean, I think the companies that are making this transition, that's always the decision they have to make. Do you refit an existing factory? I mean, I know the GM is converting a factory in Toledo that makes transmissions to make electric motors. Or do you build a brand new factory, which is what GM did with Ultium in Warren? And it's always a difficult calculation. If you have a factory there, you already have the water and the power and the building, but sometimes it's pretty difficult to convert that to the machinery you need for the new type of production. So it can sort of go either way.
Now, Chris, I want to ask you a couple of questions about Schaeffler before we let you go. I appreciate your time with us. Building off of what Chris was saying, I mean, excuse me, what Jack was saying, what is Schaeffler's approach when it comes to training workers who historically were very familiar with manufacturing internal combustion engines or parts for those types of cars, and then retraining to have them knowledgeable and have the skills to make EV parts?
Yeah, that's a great question. Schaeffler's always put a lot of emphasis on training our workforce. We have large programs in the co-op area where we train our future engineers, but also apprenticeship programs for people making sure our equipment keeps running. You know, we've had to pivot a little bit on the types of engineering skill sets we look at in our trainees. traditionally all mechanical engineers. That's traditionally who we look for. Now we're taking people from computer engineering, electrical engineering. But, you know, a lot of what we've done is take great problem solvers that we've already had, even if they were mechanical engineers, and say, what do we need to do to solve tomorrow's problems, problems related to electric vehicles? And you know, what we find is if you've got someone who's a good problem solver, you can pivot. We see that in the Tesla area where Elon Musk, while he doesn't have a reputation for treating his people great, I'll say he takes people from literal rocket scientists at SpaceX and moves them to Tesla or moves them to other areas to solve problems. And that's a little bit what we try to do as well. And it's been successful for us so far.
Can I ask you, how has Ohio as a government and kind of a business landscape been in supporting Schaeffler's growth or reimagining of how it is involved in the EV space? Is there ways that the state can improve or has, you know, proven to Schaeffler that this is a place that you want to continue having your business in?
When we decided on the new location, we did our due diligence. We didn't just look at Ohio. We looked at many states across the country. I'm actually from Michigan. I have to say we look there as well. But Ohio, at the end of the day, gave us incentives to ensure that we grow our business here and continue to create new careers. They gave us the opportunities that no one else could match. So apart from our existing infrastructure and our strong teams, the state of Ohio really gave us a great opportunities for growth here. So we're very happy with Ohio there.
Chris Shammy, VP with Schaeffler, I appreciate you calling in today and giving us some of your time.
Thank you.
Tom Bullock, I'd love to hear your reaction when you hear Chris talk about Schaeffler's growth and investment here. Do you think this is part of a raising profile of Ohio when it comes to EV and EV part production?
Yes, it is. And I'm glad to hear about their continued investment and reinventing Ohio's century-long, generations-long tradition in automotive manufacturing and automotive supply chains. That's been bread and butter employment for a lot of Ohio families all across the state. I'm looking at a map. It's not just Northeast Ohio and your listenership area, but it's everywhere from Toledo to Cincinnati, Chillicothe, all across the state. I have us down as number two, not number three, in automotive jobs. I think it's accurate to say we should take nothing for granted. We have to compete and reinvent. And the drivetrain of an electric vehicle is batteries, motors, and chips, computer chips. And Intel coming to Ohio is another exciting foundational investment for our state. Because if you remember a few years ago, if you're trying to buy a new car, there were supply bottlenecks and delays and price increases, partly because we couldn't get the computer chips from where they were made shipped in a timely basis. And so there are price shocks. So the point is that to continue to build on that those traditional skill sets and to retrain, as we just heard, those workers, we need to compete actively for automotive, the new version of what electric vehicle manufacturer looks like. And the good news is that since the Inflation Reduction Act, which is a major new law about 2 years ago, passed on a bipartisan basis in the federal government, Inflation Reduction Act has really turbo boosted the investment. So in Ohio, we've got, by my count, at least 14 sites across the state. The Avon Lake plant is a major example. The Mahoney Valley battery plant is another major example. Worth $10.4 billion of investment when you include batteries and EV manufacturer. The Avon Lake one is a great example of how a plant that was at risk of closure after being in that community and providing a lot of Ohio families' jobs for generations might have gone from closing and losing 1,700 union jobs. Now it's going to remain open and add 1,800 jobs. It's going to double the workforce, make commercial vehicles for business use, which is a whole nother dimension. Electric vehicles are going to be light duty for your traditional family use, medium duty for commercial use, and heavy duty for industrial use. And before we conclude today, we should talk about Kensworth Trucks in Chillicothe, where they have a major production center for traditional tractor-trailer trucks. They're going to add electric to that facility.
Jacob, let's bring you into the conversation. Explain your role with the Drive Electric program at Clean Fuels Ohio.
Sure. So Clean Fuels Ohio is an independent nonprofit organization. We're an educator, a resource, and an advocate for all kinds of alternative transportation fuels. So pretty much everything except traditional auto gas. We do outreach and education on the fuel types, and we can actually offer technical support to fleets and to users who are trying to either switch out of traditional auto gas or diesel or start adding alternative fuels into their fleets.
Let me ask, how do you interface with some of the statewide agencies and advocate for EV growth?
We actually work pretty closely with the teams over at ODOT, the Ohio Department of Transportation especially. They have a division called Drive Ohio, which is very similarly named. But they're responsible for pretty much everything that's next generation transportation. So electric vehicles, hydrogen, even autonomous vehicles and drones. So we helped advise them on their initial NEVI proposal a couple years ago. That's the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure proposal, where Ohio ended up being the first state in the country to have that that statewide proposal in the federal government, the first state in the country to have it approved. And then, as you mentioned at the top of the program, we were the first state to actually have a NEVI-funded site come online late last December.
I want to invite Lori from Huntsburg, who's called in, to ask her question. Lori, thanks for calling into the Sound of Ideas.
Thank you for putting me on. I'm very curious. I love it that we are getting on board with some alternative fuel ideas. However, I have some serious questions that maybe on the backside of it, but what kinds of plans are being put in place for recycling batteries? There's a lot of parts in there that I understand are not good for the environment, and I'm very curious about what plans are being put in place for those kinds of things. Recycling the batteries, or what is even the life of them?
I'll turn to Jack with the New York Times. I mean, what has your reporting told you about how to maintain and care for products for EVs that aren't usable anymore? And is there a recycling capacity for those?
Sure. Yeah. In fact, there's quite a few startup companies that are working on recycling. I mean, first of all, these batteries last a long time. The experience so far has been that they do not degrade very quickly, and people can really drive a long time on the batteries that they get with their cars. When their life is over, there's numerous companies that are setting up to recycle batteries. It's technically quite doable. The main problem now is there's just not that much to recycle. But as these more and more of these cars come on the road and reach the end of their lives, there'll be more material. The materials in the battery themselves are quite valuable. And in fact, one of the big benefits of an electric vehicle is, I mean, when you burn gasoline in your car, that's gone forever. You can't recycle it. It's in the atmosphere. With an electric car, the power plant, the battery, when it reaches the end of its life, it can be basically ground up, and you can recover the valuable materials, the lithium and everything, and you can use it again.
Let me ask you this, Jack. You know, I do think there has been for a while now, you know, the tension between those who kind of support the traditional auto industry and the internal combustion engine, or say that our aspirational hopes with the EVs are just overblown, and that EVs aren't as sustainable and forward looking as people like to think. But do you think that conversation is heading towards being over? Is that a moot point at this point? And is EVs an inevitability for drivers?
Yeah, I think they are. Yeah, I think they are pretty inevitable. I mean, in terms of the environmental effects, it's true that it generates more greenhouse gas to manufacture an EV, but after you've driven one 15,000 miles or so, you're already past that, and you're essentially you're making a profit. You're producing much less greenhouse gas than you would with a fossil fuel vehicle. You still hear that a lot. I think a lot of that is coming from the petroleum industry. But the I think the bigger question is, will people keep buying EVs? The sales, it's true that sales have gone down a little bit recently. I think that has to do with the fact that most of the affluent people who wanted an EV have one, and so now you're getting more into middle-class buyers, and EVs are still expensive. But the prices are coming down quite quickly, as you pointed out. The batteries are getting better, the range is getting better, they're charging faster, and I'm pretty convinced that in 3, 4, 5 years, not only will an EV be cheaper than a gasoline car, but it will be more practical. You can charge it at home, the fuel is much cheaper, the maintenance much lower, and I think that you'll reach a tipping point where not many people will want gasoline cars anymore.
Tom, with the Citizens Utility Board of Ohio, you wanted to add?
Yeah, Ohio has a battery recycling manufacturing plant being created right now in Lancaster, Ohio. Mm. It's an investment of $200 million. They currently could supply a rate of 33,000 EVs annually, and they want to get up to 200,000 annually. So this is not small. It's a great question by the caller. What do you do with those recycled batteries? So now that, as Jack said, the market has grown for new EVs, you're seeing the financials support a second use recycling industry. And the good news is that's a target of 150 jobs in Lancaster, Ohio. So it's coming here. I also know on this question of which is a cleaner car, a factoid in our report from a couple years ago, the ABCs of Ohio EVs, a policy guide to electrify Ohio, we found that life cycle EV emissions are 60 to 68% less than gas vehicles in the United States, and that is quickly growing as electricity mix moves towards cleaner fuels, cleaner sourcing. So over the lifetime of the vehicle, because of maintenance advantages, fuel advantages, and the original manufactured materials and recycling, you're significantly better from a cleanliness, climate, pollution perspective on EVs. On sales, I want to say we're still going fast. We expect EV market penetration to hit 13% of all the market in this year, 2024, and that will grow further to 40% by the end of the decade. That's a big deal. Hmm. We're already at 8% of the new car market in the United States, and the Inflation Reduction Act, a couple years old now, has added tax credits for used electric vehicles, which is how you make cars affordable. I've always gotten a used car just because that's our family budget decisions. So how do you break into any vehicle class, whether you're doing luxury or sure. pickups or SUVs or something else, affordably? Often you want that used vehicle market. That's beginning to come online to bring down prices. And as Jack said, the industry analysts say in about 4 years, the original purchase price of electric vehicles should be tied with or equal to traditional cars. And then you're going to see even greater savings because it costs about a third as much to fuel your car with electricity as gasoline.
Jacob, I want to ask, we're talking about the inevitability of EVs dominating the market and becoming the car that may be cheaper, more sustainable for the environment, and that'll be made. So I'm curious, do you find that you're dealing with perception problems within Ohio when it comes to EVs, its costs, its capabilities? And I know a part of your job is education. So what are you espousing to the drivers of Ohio?
Sure. And yeah, that is a problem kind of and an obstacle that we frequently run into. When you ask people to picture an EV, they still think of a white Tesla, the initial models when they were at a really high price point and they were out of reach for a lot of families. But come 2024, prices, as you had mentioned, have come down a lot, and a lot of the other major manufacturers are releasing their flagship lines in an EV model. like the EV Blazer is out. They're having, I think, some battery issues, so there is currently a freeze on sales. But you know, that's just one of a lot of the flagship models that are either coming on the market in the next few months or came into the market over the past three or four. So part of it, part of our job is that we do just outreach and education events in the communities with volunteer chapters. So we have EV owners come out, show off their vehicles, talk about their experiences with electric vehicles, and kind of try to counter some of these perceptions. And I find that, you know, really helpful, because when you get the opportunity to, for instance, get behind the wheel of a Chevy Bolt where the price point is more in the $30,000 to $35,000 range, and it still feels like a great car, that can counter some of that. And that is a much more affordable entry point for the EV market.
We are talking about the electric vehicle landscape in Ohio, both in for users and with the production that is rapidly expanding in the state. I am talking to Jack Ewing with the New York Times, Tom Bullock with the Citizens Utility Board of Ohio, and Jacob Schwimline with the Clean Fuels Ohio. I wanted to ask you, Jack, you know, we had a huge kind of debacle situation with startup EV company Lordstown Motors, took over the GM plant in Lordstown, promising to revive the auto industry in the region, ultimately filing for bankruptcy, and just recently settling with the SEC for over-promising to the public about the production of its e-truck, the Endurance. So, do you think that situation is a cautionary tale for startup EVs and for the auto industry and EV industry in the region? Or was that a company that was in the wrong place at the wrong time when it comes to the pandemic? Because I know that production and supply was a huge problem.
Yeah, well, I think at Lordstown, there's quite a few EV startups like Lordstown that had problems. I think a lot of these companies, when this transition to electric vehicles started, people thought, oh, this is a great time to get into the car business. They're easier to manufacture. The old car companies are going to be pushed aside. And I think what Lordstown and a lot of other companies found out was that it's much more difficult and costly to make cars than they thought. And it's by no means the only startup that's had problems. I think you'd say that's probably good news for the established car makers like Ford and GM, because it's emerging that really they are the only companies that have the expertise to do this manufacturing, to run the supply chains. So you could sort of look at it both ways. Certainly if you invested in Lordstown, you're pretty disappointed. But I think if you work for Ford or GM, it's good news that these startups did not disrupt the market as much as people thought they might.
So when you talk about kind of the startups versus the big companies, and we're talking about Honda and Ford and General Motors, Honda just announcing Ohio is going to be an EV hub. Now, what does that mean? And do you think that these bigger companies have staying power to really impact the region with jobs that don't go away quickly and an industry that has continued growth?
Well, I think it's there is a lot of risk here because, Honda is pretty late to the electric vehicle market. They're just coming out with a car that's actually made in Mexico, and then they're going to start making them in Ohio next year. Jeep in Toledo, they don't have an EV on the market yet. They're supposed to be coming out with them soon. So I think one of the big risks is that this whole transition to electric vehicles, it will disrupt the market, and you may see some companies get stronger and some companies get weaker. And that's obviously going to affect the people who work for those companies. And I think that is something that we'll see play out in the next couple of years.
Jacob, I'd like to read an email to you and see if you have a response. Mark it criticizes the fact that we were talking about the recyclability, is that a word? That you can recycle EV car components, and says that, in fact, gasoline-powered cars have been recycled for decades, and also says the actual electricity that an EV uses is not recyclable any more than a gasoline or a combustion engine vehicle. Ironically, almost all the electricity the EV uses comes from carbon power production.
I guess to the first part of that, yes, internal combustion engine vehicles are also recyclable. But, you know, we are, as we are building out the EV market, we are learning more about the ways that we can recycle EV parts. So the rest of the car, not the battery, is recyclable in the same way that an internal combustion engine vehicle would be. But that battery is really an opportunity for a lot of things. Tom had mentioned kind of recycling the chemistry and turning that into new batteries. And there are a lot of second life opportunities for batteries. Tesla actually was looking at using them turning them into their Powerwall products, using them as emergency backup energy storage. A battery company, I don't think it was Tesla, and my memory is failing me, a battery company actually did a proof of concept. They powered the Ajax Amsterdam soccer stadium in Europe. Off of recycled EV batteries. There's a lot of opportunity here.
So your perspective is it's burgeoning and there is a learning curve happening with this technology. Tom, I wanted to ask you, because we're running out of time, let's talk about infrastructure in Ohio and how that's looking with charging stations for those who are buying electric vehicles.
So that's a wonderful discussion, and we're about to come out with a report in partnership with Clean Fuels Ohio, Jacobs organization, in the next 4 to 6 weeks, and also Chambers for Innovation and Clean Energy to talk about how businesses can electrify charging at their workplace and how they would do that cost efficiently, why they would want to do it to attract customers and employees and maybe help their own vehicle fleet. There's big, medium, and small charging, just like there's big, medium, and small vehicles. Those are technical terms I like to always throw around,
right.
to answer your question. And so I think Jacob talked about how the DeWine administration did a good job of being the first to put highway chargers on. Those are the big ones where you have to drive long distances and fill her up. Those are expensive, high voltage. You should be, from a consumer cost perspective, which we care about as a consumer watchdog organization, you've got to be thoughtful and not overbuild, because that'll add to inflationary costs. You don't want to do that. So the state needs to do some planning. NOAACA, our regional planning agency in Greater Northeast Ohio, has some funds to implement the medium scale public charging. So a level 2 charger, that's a 240-volt line that would power your electric dryer at home. And that can help people get quite a bit of charge if they're shopping or at the parking garage or something. A lot of charging will happen at home, okay? And that is a convenience and a cost advantage because you'll actually have cheaper electricity at home because you've already paid the fixed charge to your utility company just to run your lights in your house. You have the convenience of just charging at home and not having to go to the gas station. So that's another part of the answer. You can also charge from a traditional 110-volt, super affordable for the wiring and the outlets. We should talk about how that's an overlooked opportunity to save cost and add convenience to it. I want to say on the electric fuel source, I think the argument in favor of trending towards cleaner power sources for electric vehicles is that you can do things like have clean wind and solar and other sources of electricity power your fuel. And even if it's traditional fossil fuel fired generation, there's a lot of excess power at nighttime that it's just going to waste. And electric vehicle charging is friendly load because you could give discounts to car owners to charge at night when there's extra power on the grid and avoid giving them a price break then to incentivize them to avoid the peak times in the afternoon and other times during the day. You can even do two-way charging. So consumers could optionally sign up to sell power back to the grid and get some money back. That is engineering. In terms of engineering, that's possible today. There's software to sort out, and then there's utility rules for how that payment would work. But the future would be that consumers essentially have rolling battery packs that they've already paid for, and they could use that to back up power their home or sell it back to the grid to help on a hot summer afternoon and get some money back. It's exciting.
Tom Bullock, Citizen Utility Board of Ohio, Jacob Schwemline, Clean Fuels Ohio, and Jack Ewing with the New York Times. A pleasure to have all three of you, and thank you for this great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Of course, thank you.
Thank you, Jenny.
Time now for a quick break. When we come back, dollar stores make up the fastest growing food retailers in the country, but some cities and towns, including here in Ohio, are taking steps to push back and have a say in where those stores go. And we know we got a lot of emails from all of you about our EV conversation, and we will return to this conversation at a future date. So always be listening. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. Dollar stores have become ubiquitous in cities and small towns, including here in Ohio. The Center for Science in the Public Interest says of last fall, Dollar General and Dollar Tree, which also owns Family Dollar stores, accounted for 35,000 stores nationwide. In comparison, Walmart currently operates about 4,600 stores in the U.S. A study last year from the American Journal for Public Health described dollar stores as the fastest growing food retailers in the country. The prevalence of dollar and discount retail stores have led some communities to push back, enacting moratoriums and other legislation to give cities and towns more say. The city of Canton is one of the most recent cities to act passing a moratorium on new construction for this year and rules that new stores will have to adhere to once the moratorium ends. Joining me for the conversation, we have by phone Kendall Crawford, a reporter with the Ohio Newsroom who reported on this topic recently. Kendall, welcome to you.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi. We also have Don Angus, planning director for the city of Canton. Don, thanks for calling in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. And a note before we begin, we did reach out to dollar store retailers to join in on the conversation. Dollar General declined, but did send a statement that we will include throughout the conversation. If you'd like to join the conversation with a question or a thought, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So, Kendall, I want to start with you. The pushback on dollar stores is coming from both cities and rural areas?
Yeah, that's right. In my reporting, I found that actually 18 local governments across Ohio have prevented dollar stores from coming into their communities. That's one way or another. That could be, you know, enacting a restriction, tightening zoning laws, or passing a temporary ban or moratorium on dollar stores. And a lot of that has to do with what you mentioned in the top is that they're really fast growing and they're growing everywhere. And rural areas have actually seen some of the biggest growth in numbers. That's kind of where the majority of Dollar Generals, for example, are. So it's just one of these issues, whether, you know, it's a big city like Cleveland or it's a tiny town. These cities are worried about dollar stores coming into their communities and driving out local groceries. They see kind of this proliferation of discount stores as a matter of food access, really.
And so what did Cleveland and Akron specifically do to implement their own version of a solution for dealing with these dollar stores?
Yeah, so both of those cities decided like the best way to kind of slow down dollar stores coming in was to set restrictions on how close dollar stores could be built to one another. So in Akron, you can't put a dollar store within 2,500 feet from another one. And the city's actually already used that ordinance to deny dollar stores coming in. Cleveland is doing a really similar measure. They're just taking it a little bit further. In Cleveland, the discount stores can't be built within 2 miles of another store, which is obviously a little bit bigger than 2,500 feet. But really, like, the thought behind both of those is that they feel like they have enough dollar stores and that when dollar stores do come in, they're saturating in certain communities. In Cleveland, there's around 70 small box retail stores. So the solution is just making sure that, you know, once you have one in a neighborhood, you can draw a circle around that and another one won't be built too close to it.
Dawn, with the city of Canton, from your perspective, what are the criticisms with these dollar stores and having them burgeoning within your jurisdiction?
Well, so it's from a various viewpoint. I mean, there is the saturation, which we have experienced here in Canton. But then there is, you know, the other things such as just, you know, straight, obvious, you know, trash and loitering and litter around the stores. But, you know, I don't want to single out, you know, small box details as being the only place that that occurs. But the biggest reason that we have found is that, you know, our concentrations that we've experienced here in Canton seems to be in areas that where neighborhoods experience more poverty or are black or brown neighborhoods. So it seems like it's almost like a predatory kind of nature that they're proliferating in these areas. And, you know, research has shown that, you know, oftentimes these life issues are linked to social, economic, and physical environments. So your low-income communities are more likely to be exposed to unhealthy conditions, such as environmental pollution, neighborhood crime, low-quality houses, and the number one right now, food deserts. And as a result, these small box discount retail stores are moving into these areas, and it's having a definite impact on the market force. And as planners, you know, our job is to promote healthy, you know, active, safe environments. And that's why we've placed a moratorium. And subsequently, just this past Monday, we passed an ordinance that specifically addresses small box discount retails with a special provision statute.
So, Dawn, and I think I'll pose this to Kendall as well. For those who aren't familiar with these dollar stores, is the notion that, you know, they're dollar stores, so the products are cheaper, but then the offering specifically of food is not as healthy as what you might get at a grocery store. However, the products are so cheap that inevitably, if you have a high saturation of these stores in low-income areas, that's where the people will shop, so they won't get access to the healthy foods?
That is correct. That is correct. Research has showed that, you know, the low nutrition value and that just the per serving size, you know, that's what makes the price so inexpensive, is that the serving size often is not adequate or commensurate with other products at a regular retail grocery establishment.
And Kendall, how does that bear out in your reporting as far as what the concerns are when it comes to, you know, as Dawn said, black and brown communities, low income, easily able to go to a dollar store, and what are they getting that is not great for their bodies and health?
Yeah, so it's exactly what Dawn said, which is it's these highly processed food with low nutritional value. You know, they're stocking their shelves with stuff that's going to be shelf stable. Dollar General has actually started to offer some fresh produce at some of its location, but by and large, that's not what you're finding at these small box retails. Another point I'll add to that is that research also shows that, you know, when you do have Dollar Generals or Dollar Trees coming into these communities, it's actually less likely that groceries and supermarkets will follow. So if you're already in an area that is considered a food desert, which essentially means there's limited access to healthy foods, adding a dollar store actually exacerbates that problem because, you know, supermarkets view them as competition, and then they're less likely to come into those regions that do need more healthy food access.
So, Dawn, let's talk about the parameters of Canton's moratorium. What is the goal, and exactly what have you said can or cannot be built?
So, you know, the biggest thing that we've noticed is that within a two-mile radius of our historic downtown, we had 5 discount dollar stores pop up. So it was encroaching within our downtown area. And over the past years, we've spent a lot of time, you know, reinvesting in our downtown, creating signature spaces, investing in our local, you know, merchants. And we really wanted to ensure that, you know, if and when, you know, we're all for fair market, you know, for equal playing fields. We've had a few vacancies pop up, and we know that oftentimes these discount retailers, you will go in already existing brick and mortar. So we wanted to establish some parameters where, you know, traditional neighborhood design standards, form base, it kind of comes into play, because with Canton, we're finding them more in our urban areas, and oftentimes in, you know, your low-income areas, you know, the access to a vehicle is equally as challenging. So we have a number of pedestrians. So our design standards are really driven towards a pedestrian-oriented kind of solution for the design. More often than not, you find these discount retailers, you know, set off of the street, parking lots in front, no sidewalk, no trash cans. So it's really not set up for those that either take public transportation, walk, or take other micro means of transportation to them, scooters, bikes, etc. So that's really what we were getting at, is to ensure that our street wall is maintained. And then you have simple things as glazing, awnings, you know, signage that are pedestrian oriented. So it's a welcoming environment, not just a box, split face block wall that just is set back from the street. So that's what our design requirements are.
Let's go ahead and take a call from Steve. Steve, thanks for calling into the Sound of Ideas. Go ahead.
I'm really sorry to hear that the government is sticking its nose into the construction of these stores, where people and citizens can save money over these big box stores. Favoring big box corporation stores seems to me that maybe these politicians are getting large campaign contributions, so these big box stores won't have any competition.
Okay.
They can't take the competition, so they get the politicians to stop and help them eliminate the competition.
All right, Steve, I appreciate your thought.
Lower prices.
All right, Steve, thanks so much. You know, Don, I will have you answer the first aspect. I'm sure there are people within Canton who say, let me make the choice of what I want to buy and from where, and especially when we're talking about the high cost of living and inflation prices, why not let me go into a store and decide if I want to buy a product that might have a longer shelf life, but is cheaper and more accessible to me? What would you say to that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm for fair market, but I also want to have equity and have the option available. That's what we're not having right now. These discount retailers, they don't provide, you know, the full variety and the equity of choices that, you know, more affluent areas have. So, you know, like I said, once again, you know, planning and zoning is, you know, we are set up to ensure, you know, health, equity, and safety of our citizens. And, you know, that's why this is here. It, you know, it's not for I'm a civil servant. So it's not campaign contributions. And there was the similar cry, you know, decades ago when the large box retailers would show up in town, small town specifically, and drive the business out of your downtown because they couldn't compete with that way. So, you know, planning and zoning is set up to ensure that there's not an oversaturation that's pushing out other retailers from coming in. You know, there needs to be a balance. And that's what we're really looking for, is the balance and having the equity of choice.
I want to read part of the statement Dollar General's corporate office sent us regarding the topic and some of the rules moratoriums being enacted. We believe restrictive measures harm communities by limiting customer choice, convenience, and affordability, particularly in inflationary times, forcing customers to travel farther and or spend more to access basic household and food items. The statement goes on to say, in a wide variety of communities, our neighborhood general stores operate alongside local grocers and business owners to collectively meet customers' needs. While not a grocery store, every Dollar General store offers components of a nutritious meal, including canned and frozen vegetables, canned fruits, proteins, grains, dairy, and more. But Kendall, in your reporting and what you say, the data is showing that indeed, you know, the most nutritious offerings are not as readily available at these Dollar General stores. Are there ways that these stores are trying to kind of reinvent themselves and make themselves at least appear more healthy for the consumer?
Yeah, I would say certainly there has been a push for that. I would say a lot of these discount stores would point to the fact that, you know, they are trying to offer more produce. Like I mentioned before, Dollar General in particular has launched an effort to bring more healthy food into some of its locations. Again, it's not super widespread right now, but it's something that they're growing towards. And I mean, they're planning on opening around 800 new locations in the next year. And so that is something that we could see more of as these discount stores get this criticism of their food offerings.
Dawn, in Canton, have you seen more interest in maybe the development of certain types of grocery stores in certain areas where you don't have the Dollar Generals and those dollar stores? So kind of readily available?
So we have more on the fringe of our city, and it has been the big box retailer. You know, the one thing to really point out is that what's unfortunate that has occurred is we refer to these mom and pop that have disappeared in many of our communities around Ohio and the nation. The one thing that they offer that these discount retailers cannot, they had a stake in our community. They owned the property. They owned the building. They had pride in the building. You know, these small box discount retailers, they don't own their buildings. They lease them. And they're structures that have maybe a 50-year lifespan for it. So they're not solid constructed buildings. So that's the one thing that they don't offer that the mom and pop and some of the more invested components of a community do.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time, Kendall Crawford with the Ohio Newsroom and Dawn Angus with the City of Canton. I lost my track of time because I was enjoying our conversation. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Big fan.
And that wraps it up for our show, The Sound of Ideas. Thanks so much for listening. I am Jenny Hamill. We will talk with you again tomorrow.